I haven't gotten really into the weeds on elections. I mean, this is going to be a steep learning curve for me.
The lieutenant governor appoints a new director of elections. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, July 27th. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the new Anchorage mayor unveils an ambitious plan to improve the city.
You can have a task force or you can have a punch list. And I wanted to have a punch list of things to go do.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. Baby salmon live here, right in our backyards and neighborhoods. Go out, explore, and take the Baby Salmon Challenge. For more information, go to babysalmon.fish. This announcement is sponsored by the Salmon Project.
A veteran election official resigned abruptly on Friday at Lieutenant Governor Byron Malott's request. The Walker-Malott administration was Gail Finumiai's third as head of the State Division of Elections. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
Claire Richardson is special assistant to Lieutenant Governor Byron Malott. She says they accepted Finumiai's resignation on Friday.
There's nothing personal in the request. The lieutenant governor would like to move in some new directions with the Division of Elections, and it was felt it was time for different leadership.
Finumiai has been director of elections since 2008 and has 10 years of earlier experience in the division. She didn't return calls for comment. She's being replaced by Nome City Manager Josephine Banky, who'll start in October. In the meantime, election supervisor Lori Wilson is acting director. Richardson says Malott hasn't worked closely with Finumiai since he and Governor Bill Walker took office, but they've had meetings about the Toyokuk versus Treadwell case, which is in settlement negotiations. A federal judge ruled last year the state doesn't do enough to serve voters who speak native languages. Richardson says there was no particular issue that led to Finumiai's resignation request. Rather, she characterized it as a prerogative of the administration to bring in new people.
I think it's just that the lieutenant governor would like to move forward and reach his goal of having the best elections division in the country.
Richardson says that means being customer service oriented and the ability for Alaskans to register and vote.
We're excited to have her move to Juneau and to really take a look at elections from a different perspective.
Banky was born and raised in Nome. She says she was contacted by the lieutenant governor's office sometime in the past month and has been going through a vetting process. Banky says it'll be hard to leave Nome. She's been city manager for 7 years.
I did let the governor know, you know, I love my job. I love Nome. But I think our kind of philosophies are aligned. And so I feel very honored to be asked to be a part of this administration.
Prior to her city manager role, Banky was a local government specialist in the Bering Strait region for the state. She was also a program director for Kowarik Incorporated, according to her resume. Banky has a master's degree in public administration from Portland State University and a bachelor's in political science from Fort Hays State University in Kansas.
For the past 15 years, working with tribal, state, and local government, and my management experience will help greatly in my new job. I haven't gotten really into the weeds on elections. I mean, this is going to be a steep learning curve for me. But like any challenge, I'm up for it.
Banky says she'll be traveling to regional election offices at the end of August. Banky contributed $500 to Bill Walker's gubernatorial campaign. After he merged with Malott, she gave another $200, according to campaign finance disclosures. The Division of Elections is the only division under the lieutenant governor's office. Malott is in Canada this week and could not be reached for comment. With help from Matt Smith in Nome, I'm Lisa Fu in Juneau.
Ethan Berkowitz, Ethan Berkowitz took over as mayor of Anchorage almost a month ago, and today his administration released an ambitious report on its aims for the next 3 years. As KSKA's Zachariah Hughes reports, it represents a stark departure from the last administration's approach to a similar set of problems.
Once Berkowitz was elected in May, he and his staff gathered 125 people from the city's business, nonprofit, and community groups, then set them loose, figuring out how to fix a wide range of issues. 5 areas of special interest are identified in the report: public safety, homelessness, government administration, economic development, and the city's live-work-play initiative. Berkowitz says he's surprised how consistently the same issues came up for groups working on different topics and how specific many of the policy recommendations are.
For me, what I wanted was a transition report that was forward-looking, that was focused on what we could do and what we should do, as opposed to where we stood.
The 33-page document is filled with policy goals that can seem, let's say, wildly ambitious. For example, a goal of building 1,000 new units under a Housing First program to combat homelessness, or building an all-encompassing strategic IT plan for city government in the next 6 months. But Berkowitz believes the agenda items are doable.
The fortunate thing about this is there are different time horizons. There's 60-day, 6-month, and 3-year goals, and we are going to go after them all.
The report includes a lot of novel ideas. For example, it emphasizes translation and language training in emergency services and boosting morale among city workers in the next 60 days to improve administration. One group that is heavily represented is the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation, with one whole section of the report devoted to the organization's Live, Work, Play initiative. Berkowitz says that's part of an effort to capitalize on work that's already been done, identifying problems and posing solutions, rather than reinventing the wheel.
I guess I could put it this way. You can have a task force, or you can have a punch list. And I wanted to have a punch list of things to go do. And these proposals are a punch list of things we can go do.
Berkowitz says the transition team's report reflects the same values and solutions he campaigned on. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Erosion along the Matanuska River is worsening near Sutton. As KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, state and borough workers are responding as another home is at risk.
Last week, the river's fast-flowing current, fed by glacial melt, forced water expansion toward the north bank. Erosion caused one house and several outbuildings to topple into the water.
And then another home is very close. It started to lose some of its connective add-ons that they'd put on over the years. And so it's fairly close to going into the water now as well.
Casey Cook is the Matanuska Sioux Sitna Borough's emergency services manager. He's on site while workers from the state and the borough help homeowners deal with the situation. Cook says 7 properties are in danger since the rapid rate of erosion is chewing away the ground underneath their homes.
Probably a good 60 or 75 feet, I would say. Some areas, you know, and then other areas it's going to be a little less, and some it's going to be a little more. But, you know, it's a good portion of bank that's eroded since last Monday, Tuesday.
Jim Sykes, Matanuska Sioux Sitna Borough Assemblyman representing Sutton, says the problem is caused by a buildup of gravel in the river's main channel, which forces water into a new channel. Sykes says the borough is seeking partners like the State Department of Transportation for a project to stabilize the riverbank.
You know, people are understandably angry that more prevention wasn't done, but, you know, there's been quite a lot of activity, more behind the scenes, but we're looking for partners to get a project that'll work, and we just hadn't got there before the flood came.
Casey Cook says DOT and the borough are trying to come up with a plan, but under the current state and borough budget scenario, none has been deemed cost-effective. Cook says the borough is applying for a federal hazardous mitigation plan, which would buy out the 7 affected properties and eventually remove the homes. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, despite low wolf numbers, hunting season will open next month near Denali National Park.
We know that killing the wolves on the northeastern boundary of the park has affected the population.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Spinard Builder Supply. For more than 60 years, SBS has helped Alaskans build from ground to roof to everything in between. Spinard Builder Supply is here to build with you. Alaska oil and gas have a huge impact on all of us, but how much do you really know about them? At akoilandgas.com, you can take an oil and gas IQ quiz and get the facts from reliable sources. This message sponsored by the Alaska Oil and Gas Association.
Scientists have been receiving reports of dead and dying whales, birds, and small fish in the Aleutian Islands. They think it might be from toxic algae proliferating due to unusually warm ocean temperatures. KUCB's John Ryan reports.
Bruce Wright with the Aleutian Pribilof Islands Association says all the signs point to the region having a major outbreak of harmful algae. Wright says it could be the algae that caused paralytic shellfish poisoning. The algae that generate domoic acid are another possible culprit. Melissa Good with the University of Alaska Fairbanks has been looking for the microscopic green suspects around Unalaska.
They're a suspected cause for some of the mass deaths we've been seeing, the 10 fin whales that were spotted dead off of Kodiak Island. I know Adak has seen a lot of dead birds. King Cove, I believe False Pass, have been washing up, and we don't know what the causes of that yet either, but in the past, we've seen incidences where sand lance, a little plankton-eating fish, was accumulating these high toxins from these algae in their system. The birds were eating these sand lance, these small forage fish, and were dying. And no one's, that I know of, is sure yet what happened.
This week, Good has been taking water samples around Unalaska and shipping them off to labs for full analysis. But even just looking in her microscope on Thursday, she found large numbers of the domoic acid algae in one of her recent water samples. She's also sampled the stomach of a stellar sea lion that washed up dead recently on Unalaska's Summer Bay. That's after she shooed away the eagles feasting on the remains.
Well, I didn't see anything external that looked like a cause of death. Sometimes there's gunshot wounds, ship strikes. You know, those things can be very obvious.
She thinks toxic algae might have killed it. A sea lion that washed up dead last year near here had very high levels of PSP. Standing next to this fresh, 10-foot-long carcass, Good says people in the Aleutians should be wary of eating clams or mussels right now.
We just don't know if they're going to be toxic or not. You're taking a lot of risks there.
Crabs don't keep the toxins in their meat, but in their digestive tract. Scientists warn people to remove any dark viscera from crabs before cooking them. Shellfish in King Cove and False Pass recently have tested for twice the level of toxins that the FDA says is safe. Potentially harmful algae are always present in seawater, but it's only when they bloom into dense concentrations that they can cause much harm to the things that eat them. One of the largest harmful algal blooms ever recorded has been taking place this year from California up through British Columbia. Officials in three states have closed beaches to razor clamming and other types of shellfish harvesting. Researchers think the West Coast bloom and recent events in Alaska are related to unusually warm water temperatures. Here's Melissa Good again.
We are seeing large blooms throughout Alaska of different species. When you get warmer water temperatures, they become more prolific. They bloom. You're getting a high concentration of algae.
Good says paralytic shellfish poisoning appears to be getting more common in the Aleutians due to increasing water temperatures. She's waiting for results on her samples for more conclusive answers. In Unalaska, I'm John Ryan.
In 1962, the Douglas Indian Village was set ablaze to make way for a new harbor. This month marks 53 years since the city displaced households of Tlingit Takukwan families. Little to no restitution has ever been offered. KTOO's Elizabeth Jenkins has more.
The Douglas Indian Village was a winter spot for the Takukwan people. Water flowed underneath a row of about 20 structures on pilings. There was a saying, this was where the sun rays touched first. The village had no running water or electricity, but to John Morris, it was home.
That was a trail that I used to walk to go to school right here. But my house was right exactly where that truck is right now.
Where we're standing has been filled with gravel. The water no longer comes up to this point. It's been turned into Savico Park, a place where children play Little League and families grill out hamburgers. Morris remembers seeing his childhood home here going up in smoke.
We left everything as is in the house with the thought that if they saw that we hadn't moved anything out, that they would maybe prolong the burning. It didn't stop them.
Fishing nets, clothing, dishes, everything.
There are no pictures of my childhood. It was all burned up in that house.
Morris is a carver, teacher, and tribal leader. At 75 years old, he's also the last living member of the tribe to witness the burning of the village in 1962. He remembers back then, racial tensions were high. He delivered newspapers as a kid.
And I had a paper sack that had Juneau Empire on it. And as long as I had that paper sack, I could go anywhere in Douglas. Once I took that paper sack off, people would tell me, get back down to your village.
In 1946, the Douglas Indian Association was looking for boat loans. At the time, boats were kept under the house, but that wasn't deemed suitable. So the city and Army Corps of Engineers were asked to build a harbor where the village stood, with the understanding the village would be rebuilt. That plan didn't go anywhere.
But the plan for the harbor kind of stayed on the books, and in 1962, the city of Douglas destroyed the Indian village.
That's attorney Andy Huff. He put together a formal report in 2002 on what happened. He used to work for the Montana Indian Law Resource Center. Back in the 60s, the city of Douglas found a loophole to condemn the natives. Most of its occupants were gone to fish camps in the summer.
Even so, the city didn't have jurisdiction over the houses in the first place. It was a federally protected enclave.
Two more red flags stood out. One was the Bureau of Indian Affairs, the agency that's supposed to help, did nothing to intervene.
So they just flatly refused to get involved, even though there was this plan to kind of destroy the village.
The other red flag was a possible conspiracy.
Two members of the City of Douglas Zoning Commission, which was the entity kind of in charge of destroying the village, were also members of the Bureau of Indian Affairs at the same time.
They were Charles Jones and A.W. Bartlett. Both men resigned from Zoning and Planning Committee, citing conflict of interest. But the plans to burn the village were already underway. Huff says that's an obvious breach of trust. When he put the report together 13 years ago, he thought it would affect change. But no restitution has been offered. He thinks even after all this time, there's still a legal case.
And I don't think the federal government can argue it doesn't know exactly, you know, what happened and what the issues are in light of the report coming out and being released by the tribe. Something surely should have happened by now.
The Bureau of Indian Affairs couldn't be reached for comment. After the controlled burn in 1962, the village was never rebuilt. The Douglas Harbor and eventually the park was constructed in its place. Morris, who was on military leave at the time, says he went back to Fort Hood, Texas, changed.
I went back with a bitterness that I'm not going to have anything to come back to. I don't have a home. The people that I grew up with, I got to see firsthand how they treated us people, us natives.
It took years for him to come back to the Juneau Douglas area, but he did. He says sometimes friends tell him he should file a lawsuit. He could be a millionaire.
That's not what I'm after. That's not what I'm after. I do want to see that corrected, but it'll never leave me. It'll never leave me. It lays there, but it's dormant. And I don't like to touch it unless I have to.
Morris says he forgives, but he doesn't forget. He would like to see restitution for the Taku Kwan people. In Juneau, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Many Alaskans who die in boating accidents don't die of hypothermia. Without a life jacket, drowning kills long before hypothermia does. More at pledgetolive.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Garrison Keillor, one of the most beloved radio hosts and acclaimed humorists, is coming to the Alaska State Fair with his America the Beautiful tour on Sunday, August 30th at 3 p.m. This 2.5-hour show will feature Prairie Home Companion classics with piano master Richard Dworsky, sound effects man Fred Newman, and other special guests. Tickets at alaskastatefair.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska State Fair.
Wolf hunting season is scheduled to open next month in and around Denali National Park, despite record low wolf numbers. This spring, park biologists counted fewer than 50 Denali wolves, heightening a long-running battle over the popularly viewed animals. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Spotting a wild wolf in Denali National Park is a coveted sight many visitors haven't enjoyed in recent years, as the park's wolf population has dwindled. Some of that's attributed to hunting and trapping just outside the park's northeast boundary, where the animals commonly range. Anchorage biologist Rick Steiner and other conservationists contend harvest restrictions are the only tool wildlife managers have to boost park wolf numbers.
There's other causes that may factor in there as well, but we know that killing the wolves on the northeastern boundary of the park has affected the population.
Steiner and others have asked the Park Service and the state to cancel wolf hunting season set to begin August 10th. Steiner says 7 or fewer Denali wolves are taken annually, mostly outside the park.
But if one of those is a significant breeding individual, it can cause catastrophic consequences for the family group integrity and for visitor viewing success.
State Fish and Game Commissioner Sam Cotton issued an emergency closure of spring wolf hunting in May on state lands northeast of the park. Division of Wildlife Conservation Director Bruce Dale ties that specifically to overlapping hunting seasons.
Because there might be an unforeseen effect of another regulation, and that regulation was enacted in 2013 that allowed hunting brown bears at bait stations. That potentially changes the amount of hunters out in the field in May.
Dale says there was concern about bear hunters also taking wolves, upping the normally low Denali area harvest. Dale attributes the Denali wolf decline primarily to natural causes.
Those populations normally go up and down with ungulate prey numbers availability and ungulate prey vulnerability to wolf predation.
The Board of Game has turned down repeated emergency petitions requesting reinstatement of a wolf protection zone along the park's northeastern edge, maintaining there's no biological emergency. Meanwhile, Steiner and other conservationists also continue to eye a more permanent solution.
A trade of a wildlife conservation easement east of Denali Park to the federal government in exchange for either cash or a like-valued federal asset given to the state. These deals have been done several times in the past in the state, and we need one at Denali.
Steiner says Denali wolf advocates met with Governor Bill Walker last month, and the solution seemed to resonate, adding that the Park Service is also on board. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Citing a state study that shows a sharp decline in the wolf population on Prince of Wales Island and surrounding islands, 6 conservation groups have asked state and federal officials to take steps to help preserve the remaining animals. KRBD's Layla Carey has more.
Specifically, the 6 organizations want the state to cancel the upcoming wolf trapping and hunting season on POW, the Federal Office of Subsistence Management to cancel the subsistence wolf harvest, and the Forest Service to halt logging activity on the Big Thorn timber sale. Gabriel Scott is the legal director with the Alaska Office of Cascadia Wildlands. He says the population numbers for POW wolves has not been clearly known for a long time.
Data has just come out with a reasonable population estimate, and it's much, much lower than it ought to be. So that's the bottom line, is the population appears to be crashing on the island, and we can't afford to just let that happen.
The Alaska Department of Fish and Game last month released a report showing that the number of wolves in Game Management Unit 2 had dropped in a single year from 221 to 89. Gabriel Scott says the only way to get those numbers up is to halt all hunting for the time being and make sure adequate habitat is in place for the wolves and their main source of food, which is Sitka black-tailed deer.
And one of the big pieces of this puzzle that often gets overlooked is the habitat component, and that is where the rubber meets the road that we can see. The deer population is not high enough to support human hunters and wolves. And when that happens, the wolves are the ones who go.
Habitat in this case means old growth forest, which is why the groups want to stop logging on the Big Thorn timber sale. Tongass National Forest spokesman Kent Cummins confirms that the Forest Service has received the letter from the 6 conservation groups. He says Forest Service officials will revisit the issue to see whether there's a need for a supplemental environmental impact statement, which is one of the requests in the letter.
I think with a sense of urgency that they'll look at this information, and if it's necessary, they'll proceed with another supplement.
Cummins says the Forest Service takes its role as a steward of the land seriously, but he says it can be a delicate balancing act. The Big Thorn timber sale is a critical project from an economic point of view, and it's meant to help the timber industry stay afloat as it switches from old growth to second growth harvest.
It gives a multi-year supply of timber there on Prince of Wales and stability and for jobs and giving local businesses, you know, the opportunity to kind of retool and seek new markets for the young growth trees. That's the dilemma.
And then there's hunting and trapping. Ryan Scott is Southeast Region Supervisor for Fish and Game. He says he hasn't read the letter sent to the state asking for suspension of the coming wolf harvest on POW. However, he says from the agency's perspective, there is not a conservation concern about that wolf population.
Even with a lower estimate, the number of animals there and what we know about the animals there suggests that they're viable and they're going to persist, you know, well into the future.
Ryan Scott says the state's hunting and trapping season starts December 1st. That gives officials time to look into wolf numbers and options for the season. They've already reduced the maximum allowed harvest from 30% to 20% of the estimated population.
Recognizing that we had such a decline in the estimates, I don't think it's very likely that we would open it to a, you know, to the maximum allowable harvest of 18 wolves. Where that harvest quota would land, that's undetermined at this point.
Gabriel Scott of Cascadia says he doesn't share the state's confidence that POW wolves will be okay. He points to the fact that his organization is asking for a halt to the subsistence harvest as evidence of how serious they believe the situation has become.
Asking to stop a subsistence hunt is a really extraordinary step for us to take. It's the absolute last thing that we would want to do.
The subsistence harvest is set to start on September 1st. A call to the Federal Office of Subsistence Management in Anchorage was not returned at deadline. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Layla Carey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Lisa Fu and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, Zachariah Hughes and Ellen Locke here in Anchorage, John Ryan in Unalaska, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Layla Carey in Ketchikan. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Crowley, providing marine petroleum distribution and energy support services throughout Alaska since 1953, supporting business development while helping safeguard the environment. More at CrowleyAlaska.com.
And by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Broken hips and head injuries can have life-altering effects, especially for older adults. But no matter how old you are, it's important to be physically active to prevent injuries. Activity can also increase your strength, balance, and can be done at any age. Ask your healthcare provider about activities that will improve your health. Learn more about starting a new activity at injuryprevention.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.